So I am going to talk about some of the things that are in this book. And first I want to kind of talk about why and what my motivation was in putting these words down. I'm not here to promote my book. that's what I'm interested in right now, because I just wrote it and it's like in my mind a lot. And I guess I'm not here to promote my book either. So it's a very Buddhist way of putting it, you know. I've published, this is my fifth book, and three of them have been with major publishers, and I've discovered that they don't do a very good job for me, and they take all the money. So I've decided to try to do the job myself. And the cover is really beautiful, and someone did it out of Donna as a gift to me. They made the cover, so I like that. In any case, it's, you know, the title of the book is Code to Buddhists. You're supposed to look at it and for a second not be sure if you're reading it right, because it says living kindness instead of loving kindness. And loving kindness, of course, is a very familiar term to Buddhists. And you're supposed to then think, oh, wait, living kindness, loving kindness. Oh, so this is like about trying to live loving kindness. Okay. So it's very fortunate. It's really hard to come up with book titles. I have several bad ones, and I have two good ones. This is one of the two good ones, and the other one is One Breath at a Time. And they come by accident. It's a little bit like naming a rock and roll band. I don't know if anybody here is a musician. You ever tried to come up with a name for your band? Like everybody sits around and just throws out these crazy names, you know. It's like that. And so once you get to that stage, you're in trouble if it doesn't come to you. But that's really what the book is about living kindness. And it's kind of my response. I guess a lot of what I write is a response to something that I see in the Dharma community or in the world. Of course, I'm in recovery, and so, you know, my first couple books were really responding to what I saw in the recovery world, more or less. But this is something of a response to what I see in the broader Dharma world, and essentially my concern that the teachings on loving kindness get sometimes trivialized or very narrowly defined. And so there were a few suttas and things that have really guided me over the years that for me really open up the meaning of loving kindness that I wanted to explore. And I also wanted to, the suttas themselves, which are the earliest Buddhist teachings that we're aware of, can be really difficult to read. They can be very dry, and over the years of studying them, they've really come alive for me, and they're no longer dry. They're juicy. The opposite of dry, I think. One of the opposites, anyway. They're moist, and I wanted to try to get across some of that moisture to people, some of that juiciness to people, so that people would feel more, that they were more inviting. So that's kind of what I played with in this book. And so a couple things that I'm going to get into, not by any means everything that's there, but one of my initial questions is, and is how we challenge, how we translate this word metta, which is the word that we translate as loving kindness, metta, very short word. that in English we've decided it requires us to create a compound, loving kindness, which is a pretty confusing term in and of itself, because it implies that there's some kind of love that isn't kind, perhaps. And in fact, in the English language, love can mean a lot of things that aren't necessarily about being nice. It can actually be a lot about desire, about wanting, about craving. So if there's this short word in Pali, and we translate it into two words, my conclusion is that we really don't have an English word for metta, that we don't really know what it means. We can't translate it exactly into English. And there are different translations, like friendliness, which just doesn't really excite me very much. It's okay, it's nice to be friendly, but doesn't seem all that rich. Benevolence, that's kind of nice. But like many of the terms in Pali that are kind of the key terms, we can really only understand what metta is through reflection and through practice and through living it, trying to understand it through our own experience. You know, the word dukkha, we translate as suffering, doesn't at all capture the breadth of the meaning of that word. Sati, the word we translate as mindfulness, that's just really different from that, from what sati means. I don't think mindfulness is such a strange word in itself. But anyway, we won't talk about mindfulness tonight. That's although at some point maybe we'll arrive there. So we start out with this fundamental problem of just understanding what the Buddha is talking about. And part of that is because, I mean, big part of that, I think, is because the culture and the world that the Buddha lived in was just a different world, a different consciousness, in fact. You know, human consciousness kind of changes over time, gradually. Even though we see that much of what he describes of the human experience is very familiar, greed, hatred, and delusion, for instance, as driving energies behind human life. The five hindrances, desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, doubt, these are all familiar to us. But some of the more key spiritual terms, not so much. So the first aspect of loving kindness I want to talk about is the first one that we're encouraged to practice in the formal practice of loving kindness, in the form of metta practice, and that is loving kindness for ourselves. Often this is the most challenging part of practice for people. You know, when I hear a teacher say something like, well, just think about the last time you did something kind for someone, I'm immediately like stumped. Wait, what? Does it count that I opened the door for somebody? That was kind of selfish. You know, I start questioning all my motives and trying to rank myself. Well, that person's much nicer than me, you know, that person who works for Doctors Without Borders. I mean, what am I doing just sitting around in my basement typing, you know, not accomplishing anything. So there's a very short sutta that I think is really telling, interesting one, in which there's two characters who appear in the suttas quite often, Queen Malika and King Pasenadi. And I like these characters because, again, characters kind of make stories come to life, and the suttas are full of stories. And a lot of times we kind of skip over the stories because we're just trying to get to the Dharma teaching. But for me, the story is what makes it more real. So Queen Malika was a great devotee of the Buddha. And in fact, she was originally just a poor flower girl. And she was apparently not particularly physically beautiful. But one day, King Pasenadi was passing through, going down the street in Kosala, its capital, and he saw her selling flowers. And because her devotion for the Buddha was so powerful, she radiated this beauty. And he had them stop his carriage and get out, and he made her one of his queens. We never hear about his other queens. Apparently he had others. But, you know, she's kind of the number one wife, you know. So she's this great devotee of the Buddha, and King Pasenadi kind of comes along. And he doesn't always want to hear what the Buddha has to say. There's interesting times when they kind of argue about it. But in this particular sutta, it's very simple. King Pasenadi asks Queen Malika, "Is there anyone that you hold more dear than yourself?" And I think this is a very interesting question to ask your wife, particularly if you're the king. And, you know, there's no reference to this in the suttas, and this is partly how I have fun with these stories, that I kind of put myself in the story. I go, well, if I'm Queen Malika and the king says to me, "Is there anyone that you hold more dear than yourself?" I'm thinking he's fishing, you know. I'm supposed to say, "Oh, of course, I love you most of all." But she doesn't. Queen Malika is very, you know, she's very clear. She's a sharp woman. She says, "No, there's no one that I hold more dear than myself." "And what about you, King Pasenadi? Is there anyone that you hold more dear than yourself?" King Pasenadi says, "No, there's no one that I hold more dear than myself." Okay. So they go to the Buddha and they tell him their conclusion. And the Buddha says, "That's very good." And he said, "In fact, everyone holds themselves most dear." And then he adds one more statement. He says, "And anyone who holds themselves dear will never harm another." So there's a little bit to kind of unpack in this. We could say that this is what the Buddha is saying is another version of the golden rule. You know, do unto others as you would do unto yourself. You wouldn't harm another. If you love yourself, you won't harm another. You know, he's saying that, well, nobody wants to be harmed. Everybody wants to be, everyone loves themselves, so they don't want to be harmed. Well, first of all, in our culture, when we hear this, you know, that everyone holds themselves most dear, you might ask, you might sort of wonder, is that true of me? You know, in our culture, there's almost a prohibition against loving yourself. It's considered, you know, something egotistical, narcissistic, a popular term we're hearing a lot these days. So I think when we hear that, what we're thinking is that we're thinking of the comparing mind. Well, I love myself. So if I love myself, it's in relation to something else. Like, I'm better than other people, right? And so when we're told, okay, practice loving kindness for yourself, we think that somehow we have to qualify for that. Well, do I deserve it? What have I done that makes me worthy of love? Which is, again, why I have trouble with the suggestion that I'm supposed to think about something good that I did so that I can feel good about myself. I don't think that's what this sutta is talking about. I think it's something much simpler and much more basic. When Queen Malika says, "There's no one that I hold more dear than myself," what I think she means is not that I think I'm the most special person, but rather that I care for myself. I take care of myself. And that's what I've come to define love, actually, is care. Caring for myself, caring for others. So no matter what I, you know, think about myself, I still care for myself. You know? And caring for myself happens on several levels. There's a physical level where I feed myself, dress myself, you know, rest, do those basic, keep myself clean, these basic things. And then there's the spiritual level. I come to a sitting group. There's psychological level where I try to take care of my mind and watch how my thinking is, watch my emotions, try to take care of my, if I'm having trouble with my moods, that I might talk to someone to get help around that. So all these ways that I care for myself so that, even if I think I'm a jerk, or I did something really stupid, I'll still make lunch, because I'm hungry, and I take care of myself, right? Now, I know there are times, certainly as an addict, I know a recovering addict, thank you. It's been 33 years, so I think I have something, some degree of recovery. But remembering those years, as I can vaguely remember, I know there were times when I didn't take care of myself. And I think that was more the not loving myself. It's not that, we talk a lot about the inner critic. Not really that fond of that term, but that, my negative thoughts about myself aren't really, to me, what kind of define my love or non-love for myself. Of course, everybody questions whether they're, good enough or nice enough, or they're, they're a good person, or whether they're successful or whatever. I mean, we judge ourselves. That's, unless we've gotten to some advanced stage of some kind of spiritual growth, I wouldn't know, but I must, perhaps there's a point when you stop questioning yourself, but I don't think that means we don't love ourselves just because we, get angry with ourselves now and then. I mean, some of you might be parents, and you might get quite angry with your children, right? But there's never a moment in there when someone would say, well, you're yelling at your child. Obviously, you don't love them because you're angry with them. You'd be like, what, are you kidding me? Of course I love my child. I'm just angry with them, right? In the same way, I can get angry with myself, and it doesn't mean I don't love myself. So for me, this is really important. And I'll say, part of my goal in much of my teaching is to try to make practice easier for people. So I think we make it hard for ourselves. If you're new to meditation practice, you might struggle a lot. Like, oh, I'm supposed to stay on the breath. And I just tell people, oh, forget about the breath. Just sit there. Relax. Take a break. And, come back to the breath if you can. But don't get into a, beating yourself up because you're not capable of paying attention to your breath. That'll come, if you practice. You'll have some moments. But I think we another way that people sort of set up these models of how you're supposed to be. You're supposed to meditate like this, and you're supposed to do loving kindness like this. And then we have all these models, and of course we can never live up to them. So then we're always in conflict with who we think we're supposed to be. Well, that's not why I came here. That's not why I studied Buddhism, why I started meditating, so that I could make myself into a better person, into a really good meditator. And boy, am I loving. Oh man, I really love. I'm the best lover around. When I radiate loving kindness, man, the lights go on. Now, I mean, who cares? So, you guys are all here tonight. You're expressing love for yourself by being here. You are loving yourself by being here. Take that in. Enjoy that, right? You didn't have to earn your way. I don't know, am I good enough to come to the meditation group? I don't know if I really deserve to meditate. No. I really got angry with that lady on customer service today, so I really should just stay home and maybe skip dinner. Maybe if I fast, you know, I can, that'll be enough penance to get over behaving, getting angry with that person. No, of course you're not going to do that. It's just the opposite, right? Like, wow, I had a really bad day. I should meditate and take care of myself, right? Act of love for yourself. So the next piece that we practice in the practice of loving kindness is to start to give love to others. There's a wonderful sutta that I discovered initially by looking in the index of what's called the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, this big book of suttas. And, you know, you kind of get it, there's 152 of them, you're like, you're trying to find something that makes some sense. Oh, there's one that says, pay attention to the breath, I'll read this one. But I wanted to give a talk on metta, and I wanted to draw from the suttas, and so I went to the index, and I was looking at loving kindness, and there's all these references, and then one of them said, loving kindness in action. I said, oh, that sounds interesting. Now, this is about 16 or 17 years ago. And so I went to the sutta, and it's a story about the Buddha coming to visit three of his monks who are kind of on a retreat. And he gets into this dialogue with them, with the senior, one of the monks. And it's just about how they get along, how they live together, these very, very basic things about how they keep their campsite clean, how they don't make a mess, how they don't pollute the environment. But there's a few beautiful phrases in it. Well, and I'll back up a little bit to say, you know, in the first question the Buddha asks is the most basic question. He asks these monks, are you getting alms food? So it's a line that, I mean, I've read the suttas many, many times, and I just kind of skipped over that line many times before I particularly thought about it. But one day it occurred to me that this question about whether these monks were getting food was preserved in the sutta, and it's been 2,600 years since this was preserved originally orally and eventually written down. And through all those centuries, people decided it was important enough to keep that line in there. So why is it in there? Well, my conclusion is that the Buddha cares about his monks. Right? He loves his monks. And he knows that if they're not getting any food, they're going to have a really hard time meditating. He's not going to say, oh, just go into the forest and don't eat, you know, don't wash, just, you know, just meditate, you know, just get enlightened. Come on, get with it. No, he starts with the very basics, that fundamental aspect of care. And then he goes on and asks them how they get along. And the Anuruddha, who's the senior monk, says that they practice loving kindness mentally, verbally, and bodily. So these are the three ways that we create karma, with our minds, with our speech, and with our actions. And he also says that he says that he practices both, he says, I think the term he uses is privately and publicly. So internally, he practices loving kindness, but then he does it. He does stuff too. Again, if you read too many Buddhist books, which is a particular kind of affliction that many people have, especially in this town and in my town, but at least it keeps the Buddhist authors in, you know, alms food. You might get the impression that loving kindness is just supposed to be done in your mind, right? Because all we teach is meditating on loving kindness, it would seem. But there's all these other ways that the sutta is saying we ought to practice verbally, we should practice bodily, we should take care of each other. So then Anuruddha says, you know, I think to myself, why not do what these venerable ones wish to do and put aside what I wish to do? Very simple statement, again, but a very pure kind of expression of generosity, of care, putting aside what I wish to do, do what these venerable ones wish to do. Now, it happens that when I first read that sutta, my daughter was a toddler. And as when I read it, I thought, that's a description of parenting. Putting aside what I wish to do and doing what this little venerable one not just wishes, but needs me to do for her. And I knew from my experience of parenting the great joy that putting aside what I wish to do and doing what my venerable one needed, what that brought me. And it, you know, it's one of the great secrets, of course, of spiritual practice, that putting aside what we wish to do and doing what others need, being of service, is the path to happiness, to joy. So I find that really inspiring, because here I am reading this sutta about these monks and they're meditating in the forest and they're doing all this meditation, and I'm trying to take care of my daughter and not getting a lot of time to meditate and be on retreats. And you know, you think, oh well, I don't get to meditate that much. I'm not being a very good Buddhist, you know. And then I realized, oh, taking care of my daughter is my practice right now. Right? Putting aside what I wish to do and doing what this venerable one wishes to do. Again, it's the practice is much broader than something we just, you know, do once a week on a cushion or once a day on a cushion. You know, it's how we live. And that's the challenge of practice, of course. I mean, it's easy. You know, I got into meditation before I got sober, you know, and I did all kinds of meditation, but my life never changed because I was still living the life of a, you know, addict alcoholic. So, you know, it's not that hard to meditate once you get good at it. But to live the practice, that's the challenge. It's not just the challenge, it's the gift, of course. So this particular passage concludes with Anuruddha saying, I think to myself, we are different in body, but one in mind. A very beautiful line, again, that really epitomizes the inspiration for compassion, or the motivation for compassion. Well, as we do this practice, we get closer and closer to something essential within ourselves. As in those moments when our own self-centered thoughts fall away, when our ego-centered narcissistic concerns disappear for a moment, and we feel not self, but we feel human. Just feel life. We see that everything that goes on in our own hearts and minds is shared by all humans, at least. Maybe all beings, but certainly all humans. All humans just want happiness, want comfort, want safety. We are different in body, but one in mind. It's really one of the motivating purposes of Buddhist practice. And we don't have to sit down and meditate and think about love for a long time to necessarily get there. There are some teachers I can think of who don't even teach metta as a separate practice because they feel that metta and loving kindness are actually inherently interwoven. I remember an experience I had on the first long retreat I went on in 1981. I'd been sitting for weeks and weeks. It was a 3-month retreat. And one day, the teachers put up a little sign or flyer from Oxfam saying that they were, that Oxfam was asking people to fast for a day in solidarity with those who are hungry in the world, those who are suffering from starvation and famine. And I wasn't doing a lot of formal metta practice. I was just following the breath and paying attention to my experience moment by moment, getting quieter and quieter. And so I thought, oh, I want to do that. You know, I felt very touched by it. Then as I did that day without eating, I started to just kind of have visions of the suffering throughout the world of hunger. And I actually went to my teacher and asked him if I could keep fasting, and he was like, probably not a good idea, which he was right. But looking back, I realized that just doing my Vipassana practice, just doing mindfulness practice day after day long enough, had opened my heart in a way that I already felt tremendous compassion. I didn't have to intentionally aim it somewhere or cultivate it. It just kind of arises. It's a natural human capacity, right? Love. You know, certainly the Buddha didn't invent it. And it's just, we just have to create the conditions for it, the space for it. So I think as a last thing, and I'll open it up for maybe a couple questions, just to talk about, as I alluded to, you know, I see metta and loving kindness as really being integral practices or integrated practices. That, you know, when loving kindness really kind of was started to be popularized, particularly with Sharon Salzberg's book in the mid-90s, it started to be practices taught as a separate practice. And people kind of did metta retreats, which are very powerful, and people get tremendous benefit from them. But I've seen over the years that there's more and more of a merging of the two. And nowadays I see a lot of Buddhist teachers that when they teach mindfulness, there's a strong emphasis on doing your practice of mindfulness in a gentle and kind way. Because when mindfulness is just taught as pay attention to your breath, and when your mind wanders, notice that thought and then come back to your breath, or something like that, or make a note, you know, and then come back, it can become this very dry and mechanical practice, and it can look like the goal of practice is to feel my breath and to get really good at feeling my breath. And if I'm thinking, I'm breaking the rules, I'm doing it wrong. And a lot of us, kind of that's what we heard, even though the teachers never say that, and that's never what they mean. But when I started to practice, I had that kind of, oh, I'm doing it wrong, I'm doing it right, I've got to get it right, and getting into this conflict with myself. And instead, in that moment of realizing that your mind is wandering, realizing, oh, this is how suffering arises. Oh, how do I treat someone who is suffering? I try to be kind to them. You know, I'm not going to be, you know, nice to everyone else, but mean to myself. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And so instead, in that moment of noticing the thought or noticing the feeling, some agitation or restlessness, then it's, oh. And that, not necessarily to even say, may you be happy, although that can be nice, but rather just to bring a kind of softness to it, right? That moment, oh, right, it's okay. You know, not a, you know, beating myself up, but a, oh, well, and so what I like to say is that my companions in my practice are forgiveness and compassion. When I realize that my mind has wandered, I realize that this is how suffering arises. So I feel compassion for myself. And I also realize that my mind is wandering not because I'm a bad person or a bad meditator, but because of causes and conditions. I am human with a mind that wants to think. And I didn't ask my mind to think. It just does it. So then I bring compassion to that because I realize there's suffering there. And I forgive myself because it's not my fault that I'm thinking, right? It's nobody's fault. It's the fault of evolution. It's hard to get angry at evolution. So I hope that's of some help. I hope that makes things easier for you. So one of the instruction when the Buddha says, the words he uses to suggest sending loving kindness, he says, may all beings be at ease. In gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. It's a nice phrase. So thank you for listening. And we have about 10 more minutes if there's any questions or reflections, thoughts, corrections. Yes.
Just recently, with the news about Syria, for example, the terrible harm that some people inflict on others, I have a really hard time being compassionate to those people. Yeah. How do we reconcile those two? How do we? Because it almost sometimes makes me feel that feeling compassion to those people.
Uh-huh, right.
It's anger that I'm helpless, that instead of sitting and being compassionate, maybe I should do something.
Yeah.
How do we live in this really troubled world?
Kevin, would you just synopsize?
Sure. Yeah, the question is how do we, the subtitle of the book is Buddhist Teachings for a Troubled World, and with the suffering that we see and the harm that we see, how do we have compassion for those who are inflicting harm, and how do we live with all the disturbances of this world? And certainly, this is a great challenge, and it's clear from the Buddhist teachings that the world was troubled in his lifetime. He had these relationships with leaders, and sometimes tried to talk them out of going to war. Sometimes he succeeded, sometimes he didn't. But the fact that he talked so much about greed, hatred, and delusion tells us that on some level nothing has changed. We just have, a much more vast powers to create harm. But also, I would say, to create good. We also have tremendous powers for good. So I'll put it in these terms that, first of all, I think we should do something. I don't think that the Buddhist view is, it's just the way it is, just accept everything the way it is and meditate right through it. That's not how I see it. And I look to Bhikkhu Bodhi, one of the great Buddhist scholars, who after decades in Sri Lanka translating the Pali Canon, came back to the West and started an organization to feed hungry people, Buddhist Global Relief. Wonderful expression of engaged Buddhism, doing something to help people. Right? But the other thing I would say, and this is how I'll tell you how I hold it, because I feel very strongly about a lot of issues in the world today, and I get very emotional about them. And to me, that's okay to have those feelings, because I also have a Dharma perspective on them, and I try to hold them both. But this is what we talk about, the relative and the absolute. On one level, there is just all this, there are a lot of bad things happening and bad people doing bad things, and it's troubling and painful. At the same time, we're just seeing greed, hatred, and delusion. This is just the Dharma unfolding. You know, it's just the way things are. And you know, we're, if you really want to step further back, you can go, and we're on this little rock moving through space, right, in this corner of the universe. That does it have any cosmic significance at all? I don't know. But it certainly could look pretty small from if we stepped a few million light years away. So that kind of broad view of just, you know, in Buddhist terms, it's empty. You know, there's no substance to it, is how I pull myself back from the edge. Because I think it's important to be engaged and to care, you know. But if that caring eats you up inside, then it's not helping you. You're not caring for yourself. Right? So we have to kind of balance these and find what works for us in that balance. I know some people just kind of pull back from paying attention to everything, and I think that's a valid position. You know, you don't need to spend as much time as I do watching MSNBC. You know, it's probably not healthy. But, you know, I didn't vote until I was 34, and I don't think that's skillful, you know, because I was a hippie, and I was like, oh, you know, Nixon, Johnson, they're all the same, you know. Well, you know, that's, on the absolute level, they're all the same. On the relative level, no, they're not all the same. And so I think, you know, this is the challenge for us as people who are trying to live a spiritual life, but an engaged spiritual life, is to find our own balance for those things. You know, I certainly, when it comes to a meditative practice, to practice compassion for people that we see, particularly leaders who are doing really destructive and painful things, I think as a direct thing is very challenging. And I think it's admirable to try for a few moments each day, and certainly to remember that they are human too, and that all of their destructive behavior is coming out of their own suffering. I think that's can be really interesting to reflect on that, right? The fear in someone who feels they have to have control of a whole country. You know, how pathological is that? You know, that's pretty painful. I know how painful it is to try to control things, and trying to control a whole country must be really painful. So there's that, you know. But I'm not going to hang out there for very long, because it's too easy for me to slip off into "yeah, but," and then the anger comes up. So a moment of reflection and remembering, but and that's how I hold it. So, yeah. Any easy questions? I told you I was trying to make it easy for you, so, you know, maybe a little, you know. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't think this is an easy one.
Okay, it's fine.
I don't know. I can't remember the fellow's name. I think he was a journalist. He was a fellow that set himself on fire recently in America. And, you know, you remember times past where the monks were.
Yeah, in Vietnam, yeah. Yeah.
Or if his sacrifice was thought through to provide some sort of an example for waking people up to find more balance in their lives. So I don't know where this leads, but I mean, that is an example of someone's response to a troubled world.
Yeah. Well, I will give what I think is a fairly accurate Buddhist response, which is that suicide is not a skillful action. You know, I think it's impossible to commit suicide without tremendous aversion. I mean, and I'm setting aside euthanasia if someone, you know, who's dying, you know, that I'm not going to get into that, that, you know, because then you're going to get arguments about it. But I can't, you know, I mean, I don't know what you, if you're asking me my view about this, but I don't think it's skillful. I just don't think it is. It's, you know, there are better ways to get people's attention. And it's just, it doesn't fall in line to me with anything the Buddha taught, you know. So I can't really support it. Yeah. Well, maybe we should do the dedication. Can do that? We have just a couple minutes. So, yeah. And I can do whatever I want, right? I mean, you know.
Without limits.
Boundless.
For years until midnight.
So, yeah, just settling back again. And taking a moment to appreciate your own kindness to yourself by being here. It's actually not easy a lot of times to go out on a weeknight. It's not easy to go into a room full of, maybe they're strangers, a couple of acquaintances maybe, to sit. Not easy. But it's your act of wisdom. It's an act of love for yourself, and it's also an act of love for this community. When we practice together, we support each other. We inspire each other. But this practice carries far beyond this room. When we live the teachings, when we move through our lives with care, with attention, with wisdom, we are serving the greater world. We are giving a gift to the world. In the Buddhist tradition, we give away all the benefit that derives from our own practice. We give it away by dedicating it, dedicating the merit, knowing that there is much pain, much suffering in this world, much yearning for freedom, for happiness. We offer our practice for the benefit of all beings. May all beings be free from hunger. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you so much. Thank you, David.